know what's funny is my boss, like a month ago, was like, when I hired you, I thought you'd be better at math. And I was like, I don't know what I did to give you that impression.
Hello, I have an English degree with philosophy, and then I have radio. Which of these things say math?
Gave you that impression that I was good at math. It was like, yeah, I'm not very good at math, and I just hoped you could like pad that out. And I was like, no. Now we just have two people who are bad at math.
Ironically enough, you do always say though that your favorite part of D&D is the number crunching.
You know what? I do love rolling some dice, but that like small number arithmetic is very different than like math. You know what I mean? Like there's different kinds of math. I'm doing old math.
Yeah, you're not.
I'm doing 7 + 4. I'm not doing, you know.
Yeah, you're not wrong, but I did kind of for a second forget that like shit like trigonometry existed.
You were just division, multiplication, addition, and subtraction. Those are the four kinds of math.
Yeah, that's it. That's all you need to know. Numbers aren't real.
As long as you can do those four, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's start this episode before we get into more things that we don't understand. Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Cast Without Trace, a podcast without a trace. I am Dunk. I use they, them pronouns.
I'm Jason. I use he, him pronouns. And we're doing something I don't know if we've ever done before, which is record an episode before the one that we recorded last goes live. So we're pulling it together, boys. We're doing it. Woo!
I'd also like to say that that is maybe like our most successful intro in how long we've been doing this podcast. Almost 2 years now.
But don't do the math on that because it's 2 years and 15 episodes, which isn't a great hit ratio.
Hey, we never set out a schedule, so
that's true. We had some pretty high expectations for ourselves at the start, but
yeah.
I'll take infrequent rather than inactive.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. At the very least, it was our best intro of the year.
It's our best intro to today, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, today, yes.
I'll take that.
Yeah, unlike last episode where it was two intros and a freezing.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah.
I kind of forgot that happened.
Yeah. But we are going to do something special. Do you want to explain the rules?
Yeah. So we will, don't worry, don't freak out. We're going to cover UA7, I promise. We'll probably do it over the course of like 3 episodes. But we're not going to get there quite yet. I don't know if it's going to end up in the episode that you just listened to, however long ago. But we had this idea that I've played a pretty sizable amount of Baldur's Gate 3, and Dunk has not. We thought we would play
zero.
A little fun game. BG3, for those who are not familiar, if you're listening to this and somehow don't know what Baldur's Gate 3 is, it is a CRPG, a computer role-playing game made by Larian Studios, which uses the Dungeons & Dragons world of the Forgotten Realms, specifically the Sword Coast, as its setting, and it uses a modified version of D&D 5e for its rules. It's called Baldur's Gate 3 because there are two other Baldur's Gate games, but you don't have to play them to know what's going on in Baldur's Gate 3. If you haven't played it, I do recommend it. It's very good, especially if you like D&D. But like I said, the rules in Baldur's Gate 3 are based on 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, but Larian has decided to include some of its own, I'll call them house rules. What I've done is I have compiled a list of 15 rules that may or may not be real in Baldur's Gate 3. A number of these are rules that Larian actually included in the game, and a number of them are ones that I am trying to fake out Dunk with. So Dunk's goal is to read these rules and figure out which ones are real and which ones Larian included actually in the game and which ones are just ones that I've planted to trip Dunk up.
Yeah, and this is great because as our loyal listeners will know, I love rules. Rules are great. Rules are my favorite part of any game system I'm ever playing. Rules are everything. Rules as written is rules as best is my motto. Mm-hmm. Have not had the chance to play Baldur's Gate 3. Because Xbox is weird. Yeah, big sad. Maybe we'll put a little article into why that's happening. Context. Yeah, I did make a Polygon article we can link. Yeah. I did make a thing. About Baldur's Gate. Yeah. I will send it to you, and maybe I'll even link it to the show notes. Who knows?
Please do.
But yeah, I made a thing for my advertising class about Baldur's Gate 3, or rather utilizing Baldur's Gate 3. And I did all of that with a person who has never rolled a single D20 or anything other than a D6 for Monopoly. And then myself, who has not played any Baldur's Gate whatsoever, and I don't think I've ever done a Faerun module. So, yeah.
Fair enough. So, Dunk, I'm going to give you one hint before we get started. And it is the following. There are more real rules in this list than there are fake rules.
Okay.
So if you're ever completely lost, mathematically speaking, it's better to guess real than fake. That's the one guess that I will give you.
Okay.
Or the one hint that I will
give you. We're doing math again. But okay. Yeah. Game theory, averages, probability. I will say I have not looked at this list that you've done.
Yeah, this is the first time you're seeing it. So let's get started here. The first rule I've written down is that in regular 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, the level cap is obviously 20. But in Baldur's Gate 3, you can only go up to 12.
So here, can I like ask a little bit of a question about the context?
You can. I will allow you to ask follow-up questions, but I reserve the right to not answer them.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I feel like that's a cleric feature or something, but okay. Yeah, you are my patron.
I think so.
So there are like a couple of acts, right?
There are three acts in the game.
There are three acts in the game. And is there the potential for more? Like, do you think they're going to release more?
The way that Larian operates, the answer is probably not. Okay. So like generally no DLC. What Larian Studios does, they probably won't do any kind of major story DLC. What they will likely do is they'll probably put out I don't know what they call it, enhanced edition, in the next like 3 or 5 years that like includes a lot of the cut content that they couldn't include in the game when they launched it at first. But there it is, in my estimation, based on Larian's history, extremely unlikely there will be a story extending DLC.
Okay. You know what? So three acts, 12 is better divided by three. And I think it would be like, is it D&D if you can get to level 20? That's my kind of thing right now. And then also thinking about the fact that it's a video game, some of the like higher level stuff does just become absolutely game breaking. So you said I'm going to do your whole like probability thing, and I'm going to say that this is true.
This is true. So the level cap in BG3 is 12. Most people hit it kind of early in Act 3, based on what I've seen online. Larian has had to do a lot of restructuring for the classes and subclasses to make this work. But yeah, the level cap is 12 rather than 20. And it's honest, that's a welcome change for me. That's something that, you know, I know MCDM, when they make their own role-playing game, their level cap is going to be 10 rather than 20. And I do think that's a change that, like, I know we're so attached to the 1 to 20 just based on, you know, nostalgia alone. The way that 5e is built is effectively on the ruins of other...
our fond memories of playing things from level 15 through 20. Yes,
exactly.
So many memories.
Point, right? I wouldn't mind if they just designed the game for the levels that are being played.
100%. I think that makes a lot of sense. A lot of video games do like the whole like you level up so goddamn quickly, especially in the lower levels. So I think having something that's a little bit slower paced makes sense for the D&D vibe. So that's...
And the first few levels go by quite quickly in BG3, and then it slows down a little bit. By the time you get to like 6 or 7, you slow down a little bit.
That makes sense. But that's kind of like XP.
The actual the logic that you used about 12 being better divisible by 3. It's funny you say that because like you're going to be, most people are like level 7 or 8 leaving Act 1.
That's
so
fair enough.
Like you level up pretty significantly slower after that. That makes sense. So good job. You're 1 for 1.
Nice. I'm gonna retire from this game.
The next rule. Everyone gets a feat at first level. So variant human doesn't exist. Instead, everyone gets to pick a feat at the first level of character creation.
Okay, so this is actually a rule that we've started implementing at my table. I say my table. I'm not the game master usually, but at the table that I usually play at, it is our house rule. We say that it makes for a lot of like fun, and it just like really helps with character development, especially because a lot of feats like are not necessarily like super game breaky of any kind, but it like just kind of makes your character more interesting. And this is like not done by Wizards of the Coast at all, right?
Wizards basically just like they bought the license off of Wizards, and Wizards I think had a consultant that could like veto things, but okay. For the most part they were pretty hands off with the with the game.
Okay, because that's my thing. Like if Wizards of the Coast had like more, I guess, creative control over this, I would say like, okay, well, because this thing is more fun, they probably didn't do it. But because they did, I don't know. I want to say that it's true. I'm gonna follow my heart.
Are you saying it? Are you locking that in?
I'm gonna go with my heart instead of my head.
This one's actually not true. So actually, the opposite is true. Not only does variant human doesn't exist, and no one gets a feat at first level.
The feats are like, actually straight up just no variant human.
No variant human, but there's no feats at level one. Your first feat is option is at level four. And that being said, the feats are quite, like a lot of the feats are quite buffed. Tavern Brawler's like insane. A lot of them are really, really good. So no one gets a feat at first level, but the feat options are like way more interesting than they are in 5e for the most part.
Well, that's good. Okay.
Yeah. Next one, multi-class prerequisites are gone. What I mean by this is that in D&D 5e, for example, in order to multi-class like in or out of rogue, for example, you need a 13 dexterity. In BG3, that doesn't exist. So you can multi-class into any class no matter what your stats are.
Mm-hmm. I am gonna okay, this is a thing, right? Because you were telling me that this was a thing in 5e in the last episode. Or maybe just when we were doing our notes, but you were telling me that like in 5e as is, you like for Paladin, you have to have a strength and charisma score instead of or. 13. And that's right. Every time I've read that, it's been a dyslexic moment.
Sure.
But that removes every the class possibility of like
it's wizards, you need 13 int, clerics, you need 13 whiz.
Yeah. But like for the two, it's and right.
For
like,
ranger, you need 13 dex and 13 whiz, for example.
Yeah. And so my thinking is like, okay, well you've got, that makes it so that you can't do like a charisma heavy paladin or like a dex based paladin or a dex based fighter, these sorts of things, right? So it's actually much more limiting in weird ways that doesn't make sense, because the whole point of a lot of these classes is they're more customizable. So I'm gonna say that this one is true. I know I'm on a this true one is streak. True. There we go. Okay.
This one is true. So multi-class prerequisites are completely gone. Not only that, it is very easy very early on in the game to change your class completely. So there's just an NPC you talk to, and you give them 100 gold, and you can respec your character completely from the start, which is really cool.
Wow. That's like LinkedIn Premium, but better.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice if you could just go into LinkedIn and just change your education? You're just like, let me just gain all the knowledge from
I want a career change. Let me be a bard instead of a exactly. ranger. Yeah.
At character creation in Baldur's Gate 3, not only are all of the stats rolled, so not point buy, but a rolled system, but the natural max is actually 22 before magic items.
No, that's ridiculous. That's insane. That would make no sense. True. Okay, cool. Yeah.
That being said, in Baldur's Gate 1, from my understanding, Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 stats are rolled.
How do they roll?
But this max doesn't exist. It's just like a random number generator, basically.
Okay, that's okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. That one's not true. I thought if I just put stats are rolled, you might be inclined to say that it's true. I'm not 100% sure, though.
I would 100% ask like what method they used or like what the thresholds were, right?
100%. I think in BG 1 and 2 it's 3d6 drop or 4d6 drop 1. And like just using a random number generator. In Baldur's Gate 3, drinking potions is a bonus action rather than a full action.
Is it not a bonus action in
rules as written in 5th edition, drinking a potion is a full action.
Okay, I think I've been running in games so long where it's just considered a bonus action. that I forgot.
It's a very common house rule in 5th edition, but rules is written. My favorite variation on this house rule is that for healing potions, drinking it as a bonus action, you roll for the healing, but drinking it as a full action, you get the max. I like that home rule a lot.
Ooh.
It's pretty interesting. But in Baldur's Gate 3, drinking potions is a bonus action, true or false?
I have to assume that is true.
That is true. Drinking potions is a bonus action, which is really nice. Just allows for a little bit better action economy. Speaking of potions, not only in Baldur's Gate 3 is drinking a potion a bonus action, but you can actually chuck your potions onto the ground, and it will have the same effect as drinking it. So, for example, if you had a downed teammate who was a certain number of feet away from you, you could chuck a healing potion at the ground in front of them, and they would heal up.
That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like potions need to be drunk. Like they're not like a salve, right? They're not like a Vicks VapoRub. If this is true, it's gonna make me very angry. So I'm gonna assume that it's not true. But I feel like this. Oh man, this is really fucking with me. I'm gonna go with not true. Not true. This
one is true.
Oh my god.
This one is true. So it's actually really funny because not only can you throw a healing potion at someone and heal them, if you actually take the Tavern Brawler feat, it allows you to do damage on your improvised thrown weapons, and you can kill someone with a healing potion by throwing it at them.
That's amazing. That's exactly what I was thinking. Also with the like you throw it and then wow, broken glass everywhere around someone that's already bleeding out. That's amazing.
So this one you got wrong.
I got
wrong. So far you are 4 for 6, which is not bad.
Yeah, that's a passing grade.
And this is true for like potions of haste as well. Like you can throw a haste potion at the ground in front of someone and they will gain the effects of that as well. So I guess
makes more sense because
they're smoking the fat vape clouds of the potion that you chuck at the ground there.
Yeah, well I mean that might make sense because potion of haste is basically just cocaine. You get the exhaustion afterwards too, like you have a crash. Well, no, because it has an effect on like it's if you ingest it or it's a topical thing, like basically any contact with it will also get some effect, right? So I mean, like that one makes sense. Yep.
Moving on, high and low ground give bonuses and minuses to ranged attacks. Specifically, if a character is 10 feet above their target, they get a +2, and if you're 10 feet below your target, you get a -2.
Sorry, this is for range attacks with partial cover?
Range attacks based on high and low ground.
Yeah, it gives you, it affects the numbers.
Yep, a +2 bonus or a -2 bonus to your attack rule based on high or low ground.
That's really interesting, because we never really think about, like, I guess levels in most campaigns and such, because we are effectively using, like, minis on a map or whatever. Or like chart paper. So this, like, I guess it would make sense kind of in that same idea of like partial cover and such, right? Like that is the same as partial cover, the +2, -2.
Yeah. Well, technically I think it adds +2 to their AC.
Which is the same as partial
+5
cover,
for total, which is effectively the same, I think.
Yeah. So I think mechanically it works the same as cover and the angle. I guess that makes sense. So I'm going to go with true.
This is true. This is true. High and low ground do have effects. It's also interesting because the Baldur's Gate 3 battles happen a lot more vertically than you would picture a 5e. Just because like when you're building in a video game, it's much easier to demonstrate verticality than on a battle map because you have that 3D space.
Okay, so Obi-Wan was right and it's need the high ground. Okay.
I have the high ground, exactly. Yeah. All classes, so just to be clear, there are 12 classes in the game. They did not include the Artificer. And all 12 of those classes are restricted to 3 subclasses.
That would be very disappointing. I'm going to go with not true because that is, again, very disappointing.
So this is not true. So you got this right. But my question to you is, in what way do you think it's not true?
I think that there are going to be some that have 3, and I think there are some that are going to have more just based on like play styles. I have a feeling that they're not going to include every single one like as printed, because they've also been working on this for how long?
Yes. So every class gets minimum 3. The only ones that get more are the wizard gets all of their subclasses from the player's handbook, so one for every school of magic, and the cleric gets all of their player's handbook subclasses. Every other class is limited to 3 subclasses, though.
Wow. Wait, hold on. Is it basically just player's handbook?
It's where they, like, part of their design philosophy is where they could. They just did Player's Handbook. Where there, a lot of, some classes in the Player's Handbook only have two subclass options. Mm-hmm. The Ranger and the Barbarian and the Druid come to mind. Mm-hmm. And where those happened, they added a subclass from another source book. So the Druid gets Land, Moon, and Spores. The Barbarian mm-hmm. gets Totem, which they renamed to Wildheart. Berserker and Wild Magic. And then the, what was the other one that I said? The Ranger gets Hunter, Beastmaster, and Gloomstalker. So, like, where okay. there were only two subclass options, they added a third one that was, like, a little bit off the beaten path from the other two that felt kind of more vanilla. But, like, the Paladin, for example, only has Vengeance, Ancients, and Devotion. Mm-hmm. So those are the three basic player's handbook subclasses.
So you only get, like, either Fiend, Archfey, or Cthulhu for...
Yeah, great yeah. old one for mm-hmm. Warlock. Speaking of which, in Baldur's Gate 3, one really cool thing is that being a Warlock adds a unique subplot. So no other character class gets it. It's just exclusive to your Warlock. And the other neat thing is that it actually changes depending on which patron you have. And again, that's Fey, Archfey, Fiend, and Great Old One.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like that would make a significant amount of sense, because it's hard to, like, if you want the Warlock to feel real, then you need to have some sort of connection to the patron in some way that is, like, involved in role-playing, right? So I think that would, like, make sense, but that seems like a lot of extra work on top of a game that is already, like, so huge and expansive. This is a really tough one. This is maybe the toughest one so far. I'm stalling is what I'm doing. And I think I'm gonna go with my heart and say true.
This is not true.
Fuck.
Disappointingly, probably, like, the number one thing that's requested, but obviously, like, I think you need to hit the nail on the head. It's just too much extra work. That being said, like, it is a really neat idea. I originally had rolled a Fiend Warlock in the game because I thought my patron would come up, and then it didn't. So I ended up switching.
So effectively, being a Warlock is no different from being another caster, except for you have pack magic instead of...
Yeah.
Okay.
You get Eldritch Blast, and like, you just get your... like, there's, in terms of flavor and story, it doesn't actually change much. Mm-hmm. Which is okay. kind of disappointing, because there's a companion character in the game who's a Warlock, and his pact comes up all the time.
That is incredibly aggravating.
Then it comes up
not take that character in my party. Can you respect NPCs?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I would pay the 100
but
gold
their stories remain
him.
The same. Like, you can
respect that would be absolutely hilarious.
But in terms of a story, it still treats him as if he's a Warlock, even if you change it to a bard or whatever.
That's fucking hilarious. I will 100% do that.
Moving on. Being wet, having the wet condition, gives you vulnerability to cold and lightning damage and resistance to fire damage.
You know what? I'm gonna say no, because okay. I cannot in any way imagine the marketing team allowing them to create a wet condition.
So this is true.
Oh god.
The wet condition is actually really powerful. It's a no.
Oh,
like,
my god.
If you use create water on an enemy, there's no saving throw, and it makes them wet, and then they take double damage from all cold and lightning forces, which is really crazy.
Damn.
Yep. Really insane. Moving on. You can crit succeed or fail on skill checks. So if you roll a 1, no matter what your bonus is, you fail. And if you roll a 20, no matter what your bonus is, and no matter how high the DC is, you succeed.
If they didn't have this, would it really be D&D?
For the record, this is not how the game works. This is not how 5e works.
The whole point is we're talking about home rules, right? We're talking about house rules. We're talking about it's not D&D without this. I cannot see them, with all the love and care they put into this game, from everything that I've heard, not doing this.
So you're going to go with this is true?
Yeah, this is true.
This is true.
This is true. There we go.
There's one... DC, there's a couple, I mean, there might be a couple of DC 30 checks in the game, and you can succeed on them by rolling a 20. Otherwise, having like a whole bunch of bonuses stacked on top of each other. This is an interesting one. Initiative, which is normally rolled with a D20, just like any other check in the game, mm-hmm. is actually on a D4 system in BG3.
You know, I feel like that actually would make sense if, like, you're only limited to a party of four, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so I guess that would make sense. But also, it's kind of like a why bother? Because then you've got all the modifiers. There's been a lot of ones that are true, but there's also been a lot of ones that are... This is... You know what? I'm just going to say that this is not true, because...
This is true.
Wow, okay.
Initiative is on a D4 system for some reason in BG3, which is really, like, wild. The other thing... The two things that make this especially kind of crazy is that if your party, if more than one person rolls on the same initiative count, you can, like, at will swap between them during their turns, which is really neat. And rolling on a D4 system makes that way more likely than rolling on a D20 system. The other thing that's interesting is the alert feat still gives you a +5 to your initiative, which means having alert effectively guarantees you go first in any combat.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing.
Because instead of adding +5 on a D20 roll, you add +5 on a D4 roll.
Yeah.
So if you roll a 4, you're competing like a 9 against a 1 versus competing like a 19 against a 15.
That's amazing. Okay. So, yeah. Wow.
That's a really interesting one. You may have referenced this a little bit earlier. Shoving and jumping are both bonus actions in this game, and which allows for a little bit more unique interactions in combat and also with the environment during combat.
I'm gonna say that is true. You can shove. Yeah.
It actually makes strength-based characters really good because a lot of fights happen like in places where shoving someone down a cliff instantly kills them. That being said, this also could work against you because a lot of fights happen. Like, I have had multiple characters who get pushed off of a bridge and die instantly because the enemy was like, boop.
Baldur's Gate 3 really said cool. Fuck wizards.
Yeah, for real. And like, honestly, good for them because like, strength-based characters are actually really good in this game. Effectively because of this. It's really neat. Yeah. And also your strength affects how far you can jump to, which is cool. Two more to go. So far you're doing good. The way that short rests work in BG3, they have thrown out hit dice completely. Instead, how short rests work is whenever you take a short rest, you restore half of your maximum HP. It happens instantly, so there's no like wait time or anything. It can only be taken 2 times a day.
That would 100% simplify the rules and much more importantly, I think, simplify the processing needed to run this game. So I'm going to say that this is true.
This is 100% true.
Yeah.
It's a really cool mechanic. I'm considering porting it in some fashion to my games because short rests with rolling hit dice and regaining them on long rests and blah, 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 who cares? Regain half your hit points. Boom, you're done.
Yeah,
that's it. Bada and bing, I just think that boom. Would make things really easy. Finally, a classic. Flanking in Baldur's Gate 3 gives you a +2 bonus to your attack rolls.
Yeah, so again, this is a house rule that I have like always used at like my main table. This is just something we've pretty much done
for, I think this is...
since 2019.
I have to imagine that famously,
we kind of argued about like advantage versus not advantage being, yeah. So this is our happy.
I think this
ground.
Is famously like one of the places we just disagree on a rule because I just don't use flanking rules at all at my table, and I think I'm better for it. But you have decided that +2 flanking is a good idea, and you know what?
It's the happy meet in the middle between advantage and not.
Yeah,
like,
I
think flanking, and it has to be like direct flanking for us. I don't know how BG3 does it, but like it has to be direct flanking, like. Back to back, so you like have directs, to like if you're facing an like, enemy, like your back is to another one. You know what I mean? Like it makes sense.
Yeah, understood.
Yeah, so that one's true.
That one is not true.
That one's not true.
There is no flanking bonus in Baldur's Gate 3. The only time that flanking means anything is with a rogue sneak attack, just like it does in 5e, which is to say that if you're next to an enemy, then you get sneak attack on that enemy,
which is also to say that you can't play a kobold.
Say again,
it would that also means you can't play a kobold, right? Because kobold has the attack tactics. Yeah,
there is no kobold player option.
Yeah, see, that's disappointing. Yeah,
BG3 race wise is limited to the player's handbook plus Githyanki, if I'm not mistaken.
Was the oh because okay so I did hear a little bit it's about part the of premise of the story like, is the story like the mind like flayer this, so Githyanki yes. Okay that is yeah 100%
the Githyanki play like a real like they play a, quite a large role in the story
yeah
Dunk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 you got 9 out of 15 right which is a passing grade
that is a passing congratulations grade. Haha thank you
I we're all very great. Proud of you
yeah
Again,
that's not a greatly passing grade. I'm just realizing. Yeah, but that
you,
now.
You know, like you passed, you graduated. Congratulations. You graduated from Baldur's Gate 3 school, and now you can go play the game.
Yeah. is that one of the prereqs to download it? You have to like.
Yeah, you have to get a passing grade on this quiz in order to mm-hmm. download. It doesn't let you download the game unless you do that.
Yeah, you need a creative license in order to play this game.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, that was a fun little mini game, I think.
That was a fun little mini game. And we say little mini game, but it was actually a decent amount of our time, yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
All right, let's, is it time to move on to the main course of our episode mm-hmm. today?
Yeah. So Baldur's Gate said, fuck wizards, and we're going to talk about wizards.
Let's talk about wizards, and also wizards. Warlocks.
Yeah, why not?
So we're going to go effectively reverse... reverse alphabetical order for Playtest 7 because we keep going in alphabetical order. And frankly, we wanted to talk about the Warlock and the Wizard today. You know what?
And also, these are two of my favorite classes. These are 100%, I think, like one of my favorite classes and one of your favorite classes. And mm-hmm. this is going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. Let's get into it.
Cool. Do you want to start with the Warlock?
Well, we would have to start with the wizard if we were doing the reverse alphabetical order.
I guess that makes
order.
Sense.
That's why,
let's do like yeah. real reverse yeah. alphabetical order. Let's start yeah. with the wizard. All right, I'm cool with that. Yeah.
We made the joke and now we have to live through it.
I guess that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can also like hammer through the wizard because I feel like it's not super changed to be honest.
Yeah.
Almost everything is the same except for like a cool couple of things. Yeah. I mean, transcribing spells still costs an arm and a leg. Wizard subclass is at level 3, although I'm not super upset about this change, to be honest, because I think it makes sense. You learn the fundamentals before yeah. you specialize,
so
same as the fighter.
To be clear, in like their philosophy seems to be going into the new player's handbook that all classes will get their subclasses at level 3, and this makes sense for some classes and sense for not a little bit less sense for others. In 5e, some subclasses are achieved at first level, some at second, and then some at third, and none are any later than third. But in 1D&D, it looks like all classes will be getting their subclasses at 1. Which, yeah, I mean, it used to be that wizards get it at 2, now they get it at 3. Not a huge change. I'm completely okay with this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because when I sign away my soul, I only want to choose who I sign my soul away to.
We'll talk about it. Yeah. We'll talk
Anywho.
About it.
But yeah, this makes sense. 2 semesters of basic fundamentals before you specialize yeah. in your program.
You get your first 2, you get your freshman year down, you get your sophomore year down, and then when you're a junior, you can pick your specialization.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you have to be a declared major.
Yeah. So yeah, that's you know, not many changes, although the scholar feature is, I think, actually really cool. Yeah.
Really, really good change.
Yeah, big ups for that. It actually makes the wizard, like role-playing wise, a smart boy, which I love. Every chance to actually like have some sort of role-playing ability. A lot of the wizard aspects are very like combat focused. Yeah. So having some role-play aspect is always good.
It's just like yeah. this is a common complaint that used to exist in 5e where it was like, why can a rogue be twice as good in arcana check as a wizard can? And now they can't. Mm-hmm. Now wizards can be just as good. So there you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wizards are here too, guys. Yeah. So we can do, you know what? We say we're going to really do this in antithetical alphabetical order. Let's do it. We're going to talk about the illusionist first, and talk about maybe the fact that the
we're really leaning into it.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Right?
I love it.
Yeah, the necromancer is not here. They only used 4 out of the 8.
Can we talk about the subclasses that we got?
Yeah, it's disappointing. It's more or less like except for the School of Enchantment being omitted. It's basically just the first 4. Like, It's a little so, bit weird.
Yeah, it's let me compare. So we're getting four subclasses per class, which is fine. Wizards got it's a staggering amount of subclasses that wizards and clerics got in the player's handbook in 2014. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with them paring it down. I just want them to pick ones that are thematically cool.
Or at least like more different from one another. Yes.
From each other. And so it really felt like it would have been interesting for them to have included like a necromancy wizard among the four that they gave us.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would have liked to have seen like if our classic wizard is our evocation wizard, I would have liked to have seen like evocation, maybe a necromancy, maybe blade singing, and then divination. Like those would have been the four that I would have picked as like just to get enough like variety. But as it stands,
100%. I mean, like maybe blade singing, not necessarily. I think I might switch that over for like enchantment because that is, I guess, like more of a, like a role play heavy one as opposed to the other ones. I think part of the reason why they didn't have the necromancer is because I've had a few friends play necromancers before, and they're apparently like really disappointing, especially in earlier levels.
Yeah, like I get it, but like just buff them then. Don't just get rid of them.
But that requires work, and I think what we see out of some of these playtests is that Wizards is adverse to that. So it kind of like makes sense that that's the one or one of the ones that they would like omit from this.
Yeah.
I think like to be honest, I'm not sure if they're going to pare down in the actual book. I really hope not, because then we'd probably be paying. Let's assume that we're going to be paying just a little bit more for this source book than we did for 5e. We're going to be paying for less pages, which, with all their controversy, I think would be a very bad business decision.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, but yeah, the necromancy, I feel like the necromancy wizard requires some real work from everything I've heard. I'm not a big wizard person, to be honest. Like, I don't play wizards that often.
Yeah.
I like to be able to take a hit and not cry.
This is an aside, but there was one, I played it as a diviner wizard in my brother's Ravnica adventure that he ran last summer. And there was one round where I felt like a complete tank because I had my mage armor up and then my shield active. So I was just standing in the middle of all this goblin fire and like six attacks missed me in a row. And then one hit me and I went down and I was like, well, there goes, like, there goes my feeling of being a tank.
But like honestly,
it was really good until it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. It's good while it was good while it lasted. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
100%. And we can get more into that, I guess, with the abjurer too. But, the illusionist is a little bit weird. Although, like honestly, this one might have like some of the cooler changes. You know, the malleable illusions feature is now a bonus action, which is huge, I think, because basically in the same really turn cool. that you cast your spell, you can change it and do your fun thing with it instead of using a second action, which means basically whatever illusion spell you used costed two turns to properly use it.
Yeah,
big ups for action economy. Some of the stuff is like rechargeable now, which is like illusory self is one of them.
Over the couple classes that we have here, where like things that used to be you can only use this once a short rest still say once a short rest, but you can also use the spell slot to use it again, which is really neat. I like the idea that you can use your resources that way.
My one little gripe, I think, or something that's I think maybe just a little bit weird, is they say in their like little notes that illusory reality has been clarified, noting that it can't deal damage or give any conditions. Saying it's been clarified is a bit slightly silly misleading. Because it is word for word. I have them right beside each other on my screen here. They are word for word exactly the same as the player's handbook until the very last little sentence there, which says...
It's three words that have changed.
Three words. It actually went from four words to three words, and it's just more mechanical language, which, like, I don't know how that's clarifying per se.
Right.
But, you know, whatever. It's
the,
just
the
silly.
Trouble with this subclass, and it always has been, is that it really requires like the illusion wizard's power is effectively all wrapped up in how much your DM will let you get away with. In terms of like the restrictions with illusions and how, like, how likely it is your enemies see through them and how that happens. Like, it feels like illusions are really, like, they're either the most powerful thing in the game or they're completely useless depending on where your DM lands on that. So, like, 100%. Nothing that is in here changes that fact necessarily, but, like, I just think illusionist is such a cool concept that, like, people are still going to keep picking it. I know that I have a couple of illusionist wizard concepts myself.
I don't know. I feel like I
got to bring to the table, but
I feel like a lot of the stuff that you can do with an illusion, or like the way it can make you feel and stuff at the table, is very, like, I think similar, if not less fun than, like, I guess a lot of what the enchantment wizard gives.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I think I would have preferred to see the enchantment wizard here, because I think the enchantment can be more exciting, especially for a role playing game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I wouldn't have. I absolutely, especially if they could have given the enchantment wizard like something that means that you don't have to have intelligence and charisma.
Oh, 100%. Really nice, yeah.
But,
you know, Cess Levi. Evoker is apparently the number one wizard, or the default wizard, I guess. Iconic wizard.
I think it is, like, it's the one that's included in the SRD. Like, it feels like when someone pictures a wizard, they picture someone casting Fireball in my head. And so, that's, like, yeah. This is the wizard they have to nail. Like, we were talking last episode about the subclasses that feel like the defaults, and I feel like the Evoker is definitely that for the wizard.
Yeah, the Evoker is, like, kind of, I guess, the champion subclass. It's the big one. Make things go boom. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
The only thing that really is notable here is that the potent cantrip and spell sculpting swapped places. So one is now level 3 and the other one is a level 6 versus...
Which I think is a really good change.
Yeah, I think so too.
Like, that order makes a lot of sense compared to what it used to be.
Yeah, 100%. Potent cantrip at a lower level when you're using more cantrips just makes sense. Spell sculpting, AoE spells... you get more of those and better ones the higher levels you get to. I will point out that the potent cantrip little blurb in the design note is very funny. Says potent cantrip moves to level 3. This change gives the Evoker a feature that can be enjoyed regularly. That really, like, the way they worded that really just solidifies their understanding of, yes, people only play low level.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think they're right, right?
They, like, are right. Potent cantrip 100%.
Used to come, like, sculpt spells really wasn't useful. Like, the thing that you're using sculpt spells for, again, is something like Fireball. And if you have sculpt spells at second level, it's a waste to have it for those 3 levels before you get Fireball. So why not swap the positions? I think
100%. I think it's a really big thing. Yeah. I was a big fan of that. The Divination Wizard. Will always be the reason that this is the best subclass, is I think what you put down there. Yeah,
it is.
It's like, at least the most fun subclass.
I know we just spoke about the Evoker being the go-to subclass, but when I think wizard, I think Divination Wizard, because it is portent is just such a good ability. That really the subclass doesn't need anything else to carry it. Like, even if the only ability Diviner got was portent, it would still be chosen as a subclass for sure.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, like, honestly, it is, like, I've DM'd when I was a very, like, early DM for a divination wizard. Unfortunately, it was a halfling divination wizard with the lucky feet.
I remember this.
It was our usual DM. Basically being a player for the first time in a decade. Let me tell you, this is, if you have a forever DM, do not let them be a divination wizard, because they effectively just get to be the DM again. It's just so much fun. And yeah, it is kind of like game breaking in that way. It's you get to fuck with the rules. You get to take control of things. It's so much fun. This is beautiful. You know, like the Evoker is, yes, I like this, but divination, but I love that, you know, it's just great. The only thing that they did change for this was actually the third eye feature, which actually makes it better, because it's now just basically an invocation that's swappable on long rests or short rests. If you go into being incapacitated or whatever, which is probably going to happen at some point because you're a wizard, you're still good for whatever feature you get. So it's basically just permanently having an invocation, which honestly I feel like for such a magic heavy class should be something that they use more often.
Yeah. I do. The thing that I find interesting about the phrasing that they've used here is you basically have the third eye active as long as you're awake, unless you are in the middle of a short rest, in which case you don't actually get access to any of these abilities, because it lasts until you start a short rest and you can't use the feature again until you finish a short rest. So if you want to take a short rest to read something that you couldn't otherwise read, too bad. You have to do that while you're walking around.
Which, I mean, yeah, sure. I guess reading takes effort. But it's wow.
Weird to me. Anyway, you can't see in the dark if you're taking a rest. Like, what are we, what?
Well, I guess for a long rest, that makes sense, because like at least most of the time, your eyes will be closed. Yeah, but
whatever. Who cares? Yeah. It's nitpicky of me. So
no, it is funny. the Abjurer. I put in our notes here, and I think you very much disagree with it. You know, the Arcane Ward is the big thing that's been changed. The Spellbreaker has been changed. I think this one is probably the one that had the most changes. But, like, will these changes be the reason why this is not the lamest wizard spell class?
I just don't agree with that. Abjurer is so cool. Like,
I don't think I've ever had anyone choose to be an abjuration wizard.
I'm bringing an abjuration wizard at your table the next time I play it, and it's going to be a grumpy old orc who is a librarian and takes abjuration to protect the books from the novice spellcasters at his school.
Okay, awesome. I'm going to put you up against a repeating crossbow.
Okay. Mage armor shield.
Yeah, for how long?
You're talking a lot of shit for someone in magic missile range.
Yeah, for 1 minute.
Okay. How long do I need, baby? Fireball. Anyway.
So the arcane ward is now rechargeable, costing spell slots, and the Spellbreaker has gotten a great improvement, which basically is just like the fact that it's a bonus action, and you get to add your proficiency bonus. I think making things just a little bit easier to use, or rather like better for action economy, is just always good.
So the big change here that is a little bit more subtle is that the Abjuration Wizard used to be used a lot in conjunction with the Warlock, because you could take the invocation that was Mage Armor at will and just like have your Arcane Ward basically up forever. The change they've made is that you have to now cast an Abjuration spell with a spell slot, and obviously casting Mage Armor at will doesn't do that. So that interaction now doesn't exist anymore, which is fine by me because it probably wasn't intended in the first place.
It was kind of a neat interaction
between classes, and the combination of Warlock and Wizard is actually really neat to think about conceptually. But you can still do it, you just can't do the specific interaction anymore.
Which is a bit of an oof. Although, actually probably not. It's a bit of a bummer. It's always nice when you can kind of find those like little ways in which you can basically skirt the rules, they've taken that away in this instigation. So big goof. I think that does the wizard for us, eh?
Sweet. I think so. Pretty simple. Okay. Wizard's still good.
Wizard's still good. Yeah. Next time, maybe why not choose wizard?
Do you want to talk about the warlock now?
Oh, I could talk about the warlock. I think
I know you could talk about the warlock.
Yeah. The warlock.
Do we want to talk? Like, there's a lot of notes here. Do we want to just talk about the class in general first, and then we'll do like reverse alphabetical for the subclasses?
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Cool. So in the previous version of the Warlock UA, you got medium armor and shields in your armor training. That's back to only light armor. Probably a fine change. It nerfs blade locks slightly because you're less tanky. But trust me, believe me, blade locks got enough in this UA that they don't need medium armor and shields to feel good. Believe me, we will talk about it.
And of course, like in 5e, I'm sure that when they bring out the Hexblade, it's going to bring that in if you want to do that, right? So not too worried. We're back to pack magic though. That's a big up from the last UA.
Yeah. Back to pack magic. You're still not getting your third spell slot until level 3. There's a couple things that can help you out with that. But it just feels odd that that's still the scaling that they're going with Warlocks. So I would be okay with seeing a third spell slot somewhere earlier than level, what is it, 9? Or 11?
11, yeah.
Christ, that's late.
Yeah, and you're also
I would be okay with seeing a third spell slot somewhere in level between levels 5 and 8 rather than 11. Like, that would be okay with me, and I don't think anyone would complain.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you basically get like a similar progression for your cantrips to the bard, mm-hmm. but with such like limitations on spell slots and honestly like limitations on invocations, which has gone up, I will grant them that. Yep. They're still not like exciting enough, I think, to bring a lot of combat capability to the Warlock. The Warlock is and always has been like a very like I think role class heavy class. But this is a combat focused game system, so I think really like the cantrips do need to like just get boosted up a little bit.
Some other stuff, invocations have changed. Speaking of, you know, the limited invocation slots, you're now getting them at first level rather than second. Mm-hmm. And the pact boons, which you normally used to get at 3, are rolled into invocations. So you don't necessarily have to take one, but if you want to, you can now take them at first level, other than chain, which is limited to second for some reason.
Yeah, I think it's really to keep it in line with the like find familiar spell. Just because I
you
think
can
that's
take five
get
familiar
access
first
to.
Level though.
You can? Okay, never mind. I'm full.
Yeah, it's
shit.
A first level spell. So I
okay,
don't know.
That is a little weird.
It does seem like an odd choice, but
yeah.
The big one that I think has taken the internet by storm is the change to Pact of the Blade.
Yes.
Don, do you want to take this one?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. 100%. Like, if you're thinking about making a warlock really usable in a combat system where it's not necessarily designed for that, the limited spells and all that kind of stuff really open it up for a great possibility to be like a half caster similar to the Paladin. So the Pact of the Blade is like usually one of the like packs that I always go with. So now you can get it at first level, and by default it's no longer limited to the Hexblade or what everyone uses in their homebrew. And I say everyone uses in their homebrew because if you don't, you're a bad person. you can now your all your attacks can be charisma instead of strength or dexterity. Big ups for that. We love it. There's also like some other changes that I didn't notice until you pointed them out, because I just saw you can use your charisma modifier, and I think I just like did something to myself after that.
Yeah, but it's funny because it's actually more powerful than that.
Yeah.
Because not only can you use your charisma modifier, you can also pick and choose what damage type your weapon does. Either the standard weapon type damage, or you can make it do necrotic, psychic, or radiant. So basically at first level, you're bypassing any monster's damage resistances, because I don't think there's any creature in the game that resists all 4. Mm-hmm. Either like piercing, bludgeoning, or slashing, depending on the weapon you're doing, and then those 3 additional options. And then on top of that, it also, by default, you can use your weapon as a spellcasting focus. So pretty much everything that you would want as a blade lock, you're getting now, which is a nice change from the player's handbook.
Yeah, it actually contains some of the like improved pact weapon art invocation, which I don't think I actually see in this list here.
No, I think they got rid of it in favor of just buffing.
Which I think is great. The only thing that I really enjoyed out of that one was the fact that it was a +1 magic weapon. So there's nothing here that actually says that it's a magic weapon, which is a little bit of
I don't think the damage, the piercing, bludgeoning, or slashing damage that you're doing, I don't think is magical. But obviously when you swap it to one of the other damage types, you're going to do just fine. The other thing is that like you create any weapon of your choice out of your hand, or you can bond with a magic weapon that you touch. So if you find a magic weapon in the world, you can then make it your pact weapon, and it works the same way.
Yeah. Which to be fair is like what it was, like what the pact boon, did.
Yep.
Then too, you could choose anything, yep. Which, you know, when bringing that up at the table, definitely surprised a couple of DMs because they didn't ever realize that you could just choose a different weapon basically every time it popped into your hand.
Yeah, and on like something about a really skinny little warlock using a big maul as their pact weapon just like really tickles me. So that might be a character concept I'll have to throw.
Oh yeah, 100%. I'm doing a half gnome, half halfling, warlock character right now with a who is using a bastard sword, which is effectively close to a greatsword. So it is the weapon is basically twice as tall as my warlock. And its weakest stat is strength. So this is big funny vibes all the time. I think I have a bigger, like we have an orc. No, a bugbear, fighter who has smaller weapons than the weapon that my gnome uses.
That's great.
Yeah.
So on top of like the bonuses to the Pact of the Blade. The other thing is Thirsting Blade, which used to be an invocation that gave you an extra attack at level 5. Still does that, and now it gives you a third attack at level 11, which scales, if I'm not mistaken, scales the same way as Fighter. So at level 11, you're getting a third attack, which is really, 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 really crazy.
I think the Fighter gets four attacks eventually, but the Fighter gets the
fourth attack at 20. So
yes,
like that's the way that works. So if it, like it, you don't get a fourth attack at 20, but you're still getting your third attack at 11.
Yeah.
It's the only, like the fact that it's a martial, you've now basically created your warlock is better than a fighter.
I will disagree with that. Slight
tankiness. Okay. So
I'm going to disagree with that because of a couple of things. Like one, we don't have like the action surge and stuff like that. And then two, this doesn't necessarily just scale with the fighter's attacks. This scales with the amount of beams you get for Eldritch Blast.
What, Thirsting Blade?
Thirsting Blade, yeah. And it costs an invocation to get, but it scales the exact same way because at level 5 you get 2 beams for Eldritch Blast, and then at level 11 you get 3 beams. Oh, I see what you're
saying.
For Eldritch Blast. Yeah. So it actually scales the exact same way, and most people are not using a D10 weapon for a warlock because I think you still have to. It still has to lack the two-handed property.
I don't know if that's true anymore.
You're correct. It's not true anymore. But so like it's basically the same as Eldritch Blast, and it costs an invocation.
Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying. I still think it's like. I don't know if it's something like of all the buffs that they gave the blade lock in this, I don't know if that's one that they necessarily needed, but maybe it's not as crazy as I thought it was.
Yeah, it's not like crazy out of the way, but it is like, I mean, the Pact of the Blade has always been seen as, and I think really truly was the like worst of the.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Even though I think it had the best capabilities, it was just limited in so many ways. And so I think they really did take this time to say, okay, we are going to make this good.
Honestly, if this ships in this format, it might be a little bit too good, but I still think it would be completely fine. I think I'm going to start using, at least until 1D&D comes out, I think I will use this version of Pact of the Blade at my tables.
Oh, 100%,
just because it's really cool. Maybe without the damage changing, it's hard to say. But at least letting them, like, charisma for attacks and then using it as a spellcasting focus both are completely fine by me.
Yeah. I think those are all really good changes. You mentioned here that the Warlock, of course, doesn't get to choose their spellcasting ability. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So in the previous UA version of the Warlock, you could pick Intelligence, Wisdom, or Charisma as your spellcasting modifier, which, as a little Easter egg, was also how the Warlock worked in the 5e playtest before 5e came out. And people voted that it, like, the playtesters at the time didn't like it. They decided that charisma was the thing that they wanted, which is part of the reason that charisma casters are a little bit overrepresented in 5e. Because it was supposed to be sorcerer and bard as the full spellcasters for charisma, and then warlock got added at the last minute as, like, no choice, you're a charisma caster. It's also part of the reason that intelligence is a little bit underrepresented. I think that of all the spellcasters, warlock's the one that makes the most sense to be able to choose their spellcasting ability.
Yeah,
you could definitely 100%. Justify a warlock who casts with intelligence. You could, I think, probably a gulak in particular. You could justify that 100%. You could definitely justify a warlock who casts with wisdom. with a, you know, a celestial warlock or a fey warlock. And then charisma obviously makes sense for anything. Yeah. So I would actually argue
that constitution makes sense as well, because
you're
a conduit for someone else's magic, right?
There's reasons you don't make a full spellcaster that uses constitution as their spellcasting ability for balance reasons.
I mean, calling a warlock a full spellcaster is a little...
Oh, well, yeah, fair enough. That's actually a fair point. But I think if a player had a strong concept for a change in ability score or casting ability at my table, I would probably allow it. I think charisma is probably the most powerful, because it's for spellcasting and social situations. And I think if someone wanted to purposely nerf themselves by making themselves an intelligence caster rather than a charisma caster, I would allow it.
Or just especially party if there was cohesion, a strong concept behind it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, or just like a different character concept that might be more interesting. I mean, not everyone loves role playing the same way we do. That's the point there, right? So for us, charisma is so often going to be the case anyway. But yeah, for the great old one, it makes sense for some sort of Lovecraftian horror to need intelligence to comprehend the mysteries, right? Making that a character driven decision would make a lot of sense, but I don't think we're going to see it anytime soon. So.
Which is kind of a shame. Warlock kind of gets its own version of Arcane Recovery now, which helps with the limited spell slots. It's still not great, but you get one back. Or maybe, let me correct myself. Let me read the thing again.
Half the spell slots. Before I make that claim.
Magical Cunning. Yeah, you regain half of your spell slots. Half of your spell slots is still one up until level... Is it rounded up or rounded down?
It's rounded up. Thankfully.
Okay, so at level 11 you're getting back 2. Woo.
Yeah.
So it does it effectively gives you a third spell slot to use each day, which helps. But you need to take a little bit, it's 10 minutes to recover it. You're not gonna be able to do that, necessarily all the time. So
it's actually just it's an esoteric rite for 1 minute.
1 minute, not 10.
Yeah.
Okay, that helps.
But then at that point, why not just give them an extra long rest
spell slot.
Well, this one's a long rest instead of a short rest, right? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. So it's one extra spell slot per short rest.
No, sorry, per long rest. Per long rest, yeah.
Okay, my brain's all scattered. But yeah, actually does make a little bit more sense than I thought it did. And then obviously we referenced it a little bit earlier, but warlocks are also getting their subclass at 3. The class that makes the second least amount of sense.
I would argue maybe it makes the least amount of sense, bar none.
I think Sorcerer is the one that takes the cake.
I don't know. I think Sorcerer, there's some arguing, maybe, it doesn't need to necessarily start at level 1. But level 3 is...
I find it funny that at level 3, you manifest, you grow scales on your face all of a sudden.
That is a little bit weird, I will say. But I guess having a first level, magical awakening for a Sorcerer, and then developing things further on, there's a way to justify that. When you're selling your soul for magic, you usually want to know. One of those things of are you signing up for a program of hey, I am going to sell my soul. I'm going to shop around for a little bit, and then I'll get a patron later on that's going to take my soul, right? We got to find the right fit. It makes no sense.
And there are ways you can justify this, both if you wanted to go with I have powers now, but I have no idea what is giving me it. I'm scared. Help me. You could justify it that way.
Yeah.
And then you learn more about your patron as you level up. The other way you could justify it is if you know what patron you're planning on taking anyway, you can just role play it as that you've taken a pact with that patron.
Yeah.
But
sure.
Then why do the it's a mishmash of rules and role play at that point where it's I know who my patron is, but I'm not getting any specific abilities because of that.
Yeah.
This feels really odd to get there. So, I understand the logic behind unifying all the subclasses at level 3. I just wish they didn't do it. Because warlocks really need to be able to pick their subclass at first level, I think. I think it just makes too much sense.
100%.
Yeah. Or clerics. Clerics is another one where it's this really needs to be level 1 because I'm dedicating myself to a specific god, but I'm not getting my domain at that point. I'm just a generic cleric until level... I guess you could justify it in some ways, but you could say that about anything.
A catechumen instead of full cleric. it is still a little bit strange. Although I guess with clerics, like you can, like there is, because it's the role-playing aspect, right? Just the same as you can break your oath. You can technically change your god.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Contact patron is a little bit higher level of ability, and it's really cool. You can cast contact other planes specifically to contact your patron. There's a little note here that says you automatically succeed on the saving throw, and I don't think a lot of people reading that would know how big of a deal that is. Mm-hmm. Generally, contact other plane requires a DC 15 intelligence saving throw, or you take 66 damage and are completely incapacitated for the rest of the day. So it's a huge risk to cast it otherwise, and being able to once a day contact your patron, just bug your patron about one thing. I think one opens up a lot of really interesting role play with the mechanics, but also two is just like kind of it's a very flavorful ability for the warlock, and giving it to them with an automatic saving throw is really good in my opinion.
Oh no, 100%. I also like the way that you kind of worded that of like, yeah, you can just contact, you can bug them once a day. Like,
yeah, like that's exactly how I like, yeah. I would love to play a fiend warlock who like once a day just goes and asks, like, if there's nothing else they have to do that day with contact patron, it could just be like, hey, what's your favorite flavor of chip?
Yeah. It's like, hey, let's grab some tea and chat, you know?
Yeah. Hey. And I think that could really work for some, like that, what
that
you
would
just
be so
said,
much fun.
With,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That'd be big, so that's fun. That's a neat higher level ability.
I guess it would make less sense for a hexblade because then you're just talking to your sword, but you know.
Yeah, but hexblade isn't in the UA, so let's just I actually don't think hexblade will, like, based on the changes to Pact of the Blade, I don't think hexblade will make it into 1e or 1D&D or whatever we're calling it. So
yeah, that's not that's not nothing. Like, that is something to think about. For sure.
And I think I would be okay with that. Because most people are taking Hexblade for the, like, Hexblade is such a reflavor
just for
class.
The just for the charisma attack.
And like, I encourage, like, if you're a Hexblade, it's like a lot of Hexblades I've played or I've seen played are like, I'm taking the Hexblade, but I'm flavoring it as an Archfey, like, because it's just such a malleable class flavor wise.
100%.
Some highlights from new invocations. Agonizing Blast is no longer restricted to Eldritch Blast. Now you pick one of your cantrips. And you add your charisma modifier to that cantrip's damage.
And that cantrip.
Eldritch Blast. Right. Eldritch Blast is still the best option, but it is cool that other options are now going to be viable.
Yeah, speaking of Eldritch Blast, it is also still just a spell that you can choose or not, even though half of the invocations still are only limited to Eldritch Blast. Agonizing Blast seems to be the only one that I've seen so far that actually
Eldritch Spear
has this.
Also changed to
Eldritch Spear. Yeah, okay.
I don't know about any other ones.
A lot of the other ones, like what was it, the push and pull ones, are still Eldritch Blast.
Yeah, that's true. Which feels like an odd choice. Eldritch Mind is here from Tasha's. It's really good. It's basically Warcaster as an invocation, which is really nice. Lessons of the First Ones is really interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to look at that. It's you have to be second level as a warlock, and you gain a feat of your choice that lacks prerequisites, and you can gain this invocation more than once, and when you do, you select a different feat. I'm sure there's a, like, this is basically, if you really wanted to build your warlock this way, this is
really
in theory,
fun,
like,
cool.
A bunch of extra feats. Which I'm sure there's a way you can, like, stack a number of feats that break the game. I'm just not sure. I'm not smart enough, or I don't know, have enough knowledge to know what that is.
Yeah, I think it also, like, makes the warlock so much more malleable to fit different roles within a party. Like, I can see this being, like, as they say, the skilled, right? Like, with the high charisma and potentially high intelligence or whatever, like, you can effectively do half the things that a rogue can do, like, outside of combat.
The one of the things I'm thinking of right now is they took away getting medium armor and shields, but if you take this invocation and you take moderately armored, you gain back medium armor and shields, and you get a bonus to your strength or dexterity. So I think that would be a really interesting build, is taking both Pact of the Blade and moderately armored, and all of a sudden you're a tank warlock again.
Yeah, 100%.
That's kind of interesting. This is one of my favorite little changes. Pact of the Chain added Skeleton to the familiar list.
Yeah, I love that.
Which
so
for
much.
Some reason really tickles me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems, it's so out of place among all the other options that you have, including the other options you get from Chain.
And it's not even just like a skeletal animal. It's a skeleton. It's a human skeleton.
Like, that's really funny. Like, they added some other, like, they added Slad Tadpole too, and it's like, that sort of makes sense. Like, if you go look at what a Slad Tadpole is, like, that kind of fits in the theme of a Warlock Pact of the Chain thing. Skeleton is just so out of place that it just makes me giggle.
Yeah, I mean, there is, we were talking about, like, the small Warlocks. Slad is, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
but we were talking about the small Warlocks. There's an entire possibility where you can effectively, have, like, a Goliath skeleton as the the familiar for like a gnome warlock, and you just permanently have like a Hodor to ride upon.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that would be actually a really good concept.
Hilarious.
And then Pact of the Tome gets a small boost, actually a pretty significant boost. You get an extra spell slot if you take Pact of the Tome, which helps. Like, I think it's actually a really good option. You still get your cantrips, and it acts as a spellcasting focus for you. But getting the extra spell slot, again, like we've discussed this ad nauseum, Warlocks are thirsting for spell slots. So this is a really easy way to get an extra one. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that these are no longer mutually exclusive.
Yeah, you can get, all of them.
You can be a Warlock who has Pact of the Blade, Pact of the Chain, and Pact of the Tome, and nothing's stopping you from doing that, which I think is really neat.
Yeah, that would be the ultimate pact magic, I think.
Yeah, and you flavor it as like each are from a different patron.
Yeah, you gotta catch them all.
Oh, this is my blade, and it's from my Fae patron, and this is my book, and it's from my Gulak patron. Anyway.
You're actually just a content creator, and this is Patreon.
Exactly.
Multiple patrons. I'm actually realizing though, like if you are going to like choose one, or potentially choose two, like obviously, 5e Pact of the Blade was kind of poo.
It was, but I would say in 5e, it was Pact of the Chain was number one. And then Pact of the Tome was pretty good on your niche build, on some niche builds. And then Pact of the Blade was a noob trap.
Yeah, 100%.
Unless you were playing a Hexblade, in which case it was pretty good.
Or really spec'd out your like strength or dex or whatever.
Yeah, if you you could play a blade lock, but then like you'd be like a 14 charisma warlock, and you'd need dexterity or strength, and you'd need other stuff. Like, it felt like kind of a noob trap, and it feels like all three are. I think blade is the most powerful now. Tome is second, and Chain is third.
I don't know. I honestly cannot tell which of Pact of the Tome or Pact of the Blade are better by themselves, because I remember we're also removing Thirsting Blade from that equation.
Yeah, fair enough.
Pact of the Chain really does kind of feel like the jump in this one. Yeah,
I mean, having a familiar is always good, right? That's the thing.
Having a familiar is fun, but I mean, like mechanically speaking, it kind of feels
like
a jump.
Standalone, it might be the weakest of the three.
Yeah,
now, which is
hilarious.
It is what one is going to be the weakest, right? So
yeah.
It might as well be Chain. Some overall changes to subclasses. So we're getting four. In reverse alphabetical order, it's Great Old One, Fiend, Celestial, and Archfey, which are the three from the Player's Handbook, plus Celestial from Xanathar's Guide to Everything thrown in there, which is a really cool selection, I think.
It's an interesting one, that's for sure.
I think adding Celestial as the fourth option actually is really cool, because it opens up like a support option for Warlocks. It's very different from the other three. And I think Celestial Warlock is one that, now that it's kind of, or if it ends up being a base class option, I think is going to be a really interesting choice.
I've only encountered it once at the table, to be honest. It's never really grasped me. I thought if anything, they might like add, well, either the Hexblade, would probably be like the more obvious choice. But if they're kind of removing
I think they're just chucking that.
Then I would probably do the Lurker of the Deep. Just because it's Fathomless. The Fathomless, yes.
Which is
weird. I gotta remember what the thing is called.
Fine. It was called like Lurker in the Deep is a cooler name, and it's from UA, so whatever.
But yeah, let's get into what is probably somewhat similar to the Fathomless Lurker of the Deep, which is the Great Old One.
Yeah, so Great Old One got a massive facelift. Some really cool stuff. Awakened Mind, which is like the base ability, which in 5e was just an unlimited telepathy, but it was only within 30 feet, has changed quite a bit. It has a way longer range. You have a number of miles equal to your charisma modifier, something along those, or proficiency bonus, but it only lasts a certain number of minutes versus being infinite. That's changed because your 6th level ability now interacts with Awakened Mind directly, and you can force, if they fail a saving throw, force someone to have disadvantage on attack rolls against you, which is really neat. A lot more interactive than this ability used to be. But I think the big standout is probably Psychic Spells. Which does two things for you. One is that you can change the damage of any warlock spell that you cast to psychic, which is a highly unresisted spell type.
And that is including Eldritch Blast.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. When you cast a warlock spell that is enchantment or illusion, you can ignore verbal and somatic components, effectively giving you like a pseudo subtle spell on all of your enchantment or illusion spells, which is really flavorful and really cool. And like these two changes, the clairvoyant combatant, which is that like the changes to Awakened Mind and the way that it interacts with the level 6 ability, plus these psychic spells, really makes me want to play a great old woman warlock. It's a really big boost to their power, which was needed because great old one was traditionally considered one of the weaker subclasses.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you know, like a weird horror fiction is like a big area of interest for me. It's always something I very much enjoyed. It's you know, my most expensive tattoo was built upon that. yeah, it's just, it's the I've never played the Great Old One because it's just never been as it's just never been as good as the other subclasses. So this actually makes it more interesting to play.
Yep, for sure. Thought Shield stays the same. Other than, no, it's the exact same.
Yeah,
there's no, yeah, exact same. But you also get another 10th level ability, which is Eldritch Hex, which is you always have the Hex spell prepared, which is great because as a warlock, you're generally going to want that spell anyway. And when you cast Hex, the target has disadvantage on saving throws of the chosen ability for the duration of the spell, which is great because it used to just be standard Hex is just skill checks. Of that ability, and now it's saving throws, which means that you can stack that with some spells that you cast, and all of a sudden enemies are failing saving throws way more than they should be. Also interacts with the new 14th level ability, which has the same name as the Player's Handbook version, but don't be fooled because it's extremely different. Instead of making someone your thrall, like basically taking their mind over, you're summoning a aberration based on the summon aberration spell from Natasha's Cauldron of Everything. Really good ability. Like anything that summons a big pile of hit points like that to take hits for you is going to be good. It's also super cool that you're ripping something from like the far realm into our world to just smack things around and then leave. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Of just like wrenching something from another world and like bringing it into ours and then just like having it do your thing. Like I love that as a great old one ability.
Yeah. Just quite literally summoning an Eldritch Horror to scare the shit out of your enemies. Absolutely amazing. And yeah, the Hex aspect there is quite cool. The nomenclature, it is a very different ability. This is actually, I think, more linguistically speaking correct.
What's that?
This is a more appropriate thing for the name Create Thrall.
Yeah.
Than the old one. So like it's just I don't know, it was kinda weird, but
So Great Old One, huge facelift, really makes it like an appealing choice for a subclass. Fiend is largely unchanged. Dark One's Blessing got a small buff. Instead of you having to be the one that drops the hit points, if someone else reduces the hit points to zero within 10 feet of you, you also gain your temporary hit points, which is fine. It's not going to make a huge difference a lot of the time, but it helps.
I mean, I personally think it will if, because the dark, like the Fiend Warlock has always been associated with the Pact of the Blade. So if you are doing that melee damage, then you are getting into that 10-foot range. I guess you're going to
be within melee range of your other buddies.
And it's the person that drops, right? The enemy that drops you're within 10 feet of. So yeah, as long as you're melee focused, you're getting this benefit much more often.
And you're getting that benefit a lot more often. And like, because Pact of the Blade has been upgraded, that Fiend Pact of the Blade combination becomes a lot better. Mm-hmm. There used to be like a really niche multi-class build that was Fiend Warlock plus Barbarian, and who knows if that will survive as it stands in 1D&D, but if it does, this is a cool change for that mm-hmm. as well. Hurl Through Hell got changed slightly. The damage has been decreased by 2 dice, so instead of doing 10d10, it does 8d10, which probably doesn't matter that much, because it makes the enemy incapacitated for a turn, rather than just returning them to their spot. Yeah. So you basically get a free turn. You do a slightly less damage on the effect, but then you get a free turn to wail on them when they get back, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, 100%.
So just overall some small buffs to the Fiend Warlock. Celestial, which again, really interesting inclusion, mm-hmm. Has the least amount of changes. The one thing that I would love to call out is the Radiant Soul ability, which I will read it really quick. You have resistance to radiant damage, and when you cast a spell that deals radiant or fire damage, you can add your charisma modifier to one radiant or fire damage roll of that spell against its targets. My understanding is the way that this is going to work with Green Flameblade is because you're doing fire damage and it's a warlock cantrip, if you take Agonizing Blast, it stacks Ooh. With this, so you're adding your charisma modifier twice over, to the damage yeah. of Green Flameblade, which means that Celestial Blade Lock Green Flameblade build is actually really appealing to me.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a really, really cool build.
Okay, so now we're actually entering a point in which is the Celestial Warlock potentially a better paladin than some paladins?
Than the paladin? It's hard to say, right? Mm. Like, Smite is still amazing, and you get, like, sort of a weaker version of it. There's an Eldritch Smite ability, which isn't quite as good.
Yeah, but this is quite literally, like, this is the most angelic, like, archangel.
Right. This is crazy.
This is the sword.
When you need dirty work done, like, you don't call the paladin. You call the blade lock, the Celestial Blade Lock.
Yeah, you call the Archangel Gabriel, and this is
wielding
his Sword of Fire. This is fantastic. I'm sorry.
Yeah, really, really good. And again, like that's going to be a build that I think pops up a lot, or that you'll see if this makes it to publication the way that it is now. Mm-hmm. You'll probably see Green Flameblade Celestial Blade Lock pop up a lot as like a common build for a Warlock. Finally, Archfey. Really massive overhaul for Archfey, which used to be like kind of a middling subclass.
Mm-hmm.
What they've done basically is they've just made the Archfey the teleportation lock, because almost all of your abilities have to do with gaining Misty Step or modifying Misty Step.
Which honestly is kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm for it.
And I think it's another thing that synergizes super well with Pact of the Blade, where if like you're a melee character, one of your biggest disadvantages is like your mobility and being able to hit enemies that are far away from you.
Yeah,
if you have a number of teleportations that you can do a day, then all of a sudden you can close that gap a lot easier.
Oh, here's a question then. At level 11, how many teleportations can you do in one turn?
Let me look. So Steps of the Fey, you gain, you can cast Misty Step without expending a spell slot equal to your charisma modifier. But on top of that, you can cast spell slots to cast Misty Step. So at level 11, you have 3 spell slots that you can cast Misty Step with. When you take the minute to recharge your spell slots, you gain 2 more uses of Misty Step, and then your charisma modifier should be +5 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you get 5 more Misty Steps, which is 10 Misty Steps. In addition, at level 6, you can cast Misty Step as a response to taking damage. Being able to do it as, on your turn, you can cast it as a reaction as well. Bewitching Magic, immediately after you cast an enchantment or illusion spell using an action in a spell slot, you can cast Misty Step as part of the same action without expending a spell slot. So at level 14, every spell that you cast is also Misty Step.
Yeah.
Plus the 5 Misty Steps that you get, plus all the bonus, like the spell slots you get back on your short rests. Mm-hmm. So you're teleporting a lot.
you can basically be teleporting and attacking, like you have 3 attacks.
Yeah. All the time.
And then you could also do it on your reaction. So like you can easily be teleporting and attacking and teleporting away, like multiple times in one turn.
It's funny because I think when we talk about like what's the most powerful pact boon now, even though they're not pact boons anymore, I think Blade is the most powerful for Archfey, Celestial, and Fiend.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of like, you would probably take.
Yeah.
Goo is like, it doesn't synergize near quite as well because you're spellcasting more. So I'd probably take Tome with Goo.
Yeah.
Default. But Archfey, Celestial, and Fiend all have really good synergy with Pact of the Blade.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it like Pact of the Blade has become, it's gone from kind of a joke choice to like the this best is, choice yeah. in this way.
I'm loving it. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah, no kidding. So what's your overall take from the Wizard and the Warlock?
I think the Wizard is very largely unchanged, which I think makes a little bit of sense considering the Wizard has always been like a pretty solid class, very much so like for the like power gamers, mechanic folks, you know, the perfect optimization for a 3-person party is a wizard, a cleric, and a fighter. That is the most like mechanically sound combination. You want to have a charisma boy in there, that's 4, right? So this is like it's always been solid. So the couple of like buffs it got, and making some of those switches between 6-level features and 3rd-level features, honestly fantastic. The Warlock, I think the Warlock has gotten a lot of really good benefits, and I think this is like the one thing I really felt like was needed out of this like playtest material. I think like the Warlock, I at the point that we were at with all the playtest material we had seen so far up to this point, I think the Warlock was going to be the make or break for this content for me. Like it was and we've passed the vibe check, so
I'm really hot on this Warlock. Yeah, the subclasses that needed a facelift got them, and this like the mechanics changes I think are all, if not like slightly too powerful in the sense of the Blade Lock, like I think they were all very, very good.
And I don't want to sleep on the fact that like you do get more invocations per level. Like it's not just that it's starting earlier. It's you like right away. Like 1st level you have 1, 2nd level you have 3.
You jump up to 3.
Yeah. Level 5 you have 5.
Which is up from 2, I think.
Yeah, it was 2 for a while in the player's handbook. Well, I guess it was 2 until 4th level, which was 3, and then you were 3 until 10. 10 was 4, and you.
Really?
Oh, no, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong. I'm looking at the cantrips. You're 2 until level 5.
Okay.
Level 7, you get 4, but you only ever get up to 8. And
we're
you're,
up to 10.
Yeah, we're up to 10 here, and it scales great.
So yeah, I'm really into the Warlock changes that have been made. Like Warlock was already high on my list of favorite classes, and I think it's like this does nothing but improve it in my eyes.
Mm-hmm. This is a big addition for Warlocks.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more lukewarm on the Wizard, but I think if it ends up like I just wish there was more variety in the subclasses, which is kind of an issue in 5th edition too, to be honest, where like your Wizard feels like a Wizard, and then like the subclasses are kind of.
It's more just or less just what of, like what spells you want, like that that's really what it is.
Yeah, which is like I don't think they've changed that, which is not like again it's not necessarily a problem. Some classes are more defined by their subclass, and some classes are more defined by the base class themselves. And Wizard just tends to be the latter, so it's just a design decision, and I don't necessarily disagree with it. But I just again I would have liked to see a little bit more variety in the subclass options, but overall not a problem.
Yeah. I mean, talking about, like, I mean, yeah, I think really what it comes down to is Wizard has 2 varieties in their subclass, which is Divination and not Divination.
Yeah, that's, well, yeah, Divination, not Divination, and then Bladesinger.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
kind of it. Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's all we got for this this episode.
That's all we
next
got.
Time,
that's a good amount,
we're going to talk about probably the Sorcerer, the Fighter, and then maybe if we can sneak in the Barbarian.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that, too.
Yeah, I think we can do it. Yeah,
I think overall, like feelings are high. We mentioned last time that like this UA was received overall much better than UA6, and I think even just looking at the Wizard and the Warlock, we can see why that was. The changes are a little bit more palatable than the previous one.
Yeah, I think coming to the end of our recording for the previous UA, we had very much like said, at least for that first half, we were like, yeah, this is not good. This yeah. we feel like we've been riding this kind of bummer train for a while, and I think at this we got higher energy.
Yep. Yeah.
Is there anything you want to plug here at the end?
Still just I almost just said Cast Without Trace, but you're
yeah you should definitely Trace, check out Cast Without Trace.
Go check out yeah. Cast Without Trace. It has some yeah. cool hosts.
We have like a social media D&D. Yeah.
Yeah, just Front Porch Music still, like still going strong. Again, we're going through until the end of October for season two. So if you haven't listened to us yet, now is a good time to get in. And if you want to wait until October and then kind of just binge season two. I wouldn't be upset if you did that, because we have been looking at the analytics, and there's a not insignificant amount of people who just like listen to six episodes in one day when they discover us. So that's kind of that. The only other thing I want to say is, I mean, they're a bigger podcast than we are, but I've been listening to a lot of Dungeon Master of None, which mm-hmm. is a really good D&D podcast that's kind of similar to us. And they've just had some really like they've been on a hot streak in terms of like good episodes lately. So I'd highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, definitely will do. And yeah, we'll put a little link into the show notes for that too.
Yeah. What about you, Dunk?
Honestly, just very much focusing on stuff that is, I guess, like not necessarily fun public content. Primarily school. But still got something fun in the works, but again, it's reliance on other public media, so it's gonna be after things are resolved with that whole SAG strike thing. Which means that we have to wait until company owners become less greedy. So we'll see when that happens.
See you at the heat death of the universe.
Quite literally. or at least the heat death of our planet. we brought it back to the bummer. You can check out like my stuff at my social media feed. I'll put it in there.
You can check out the stuff at the place.
Check out the stuff at the place. We have social media as well.
We have social medias too. CWTPOD on Instagram. We don't use our Twitter account. It's dead.
I don't even have Twitter on my phone anymore.
I deleted Twitter off my phone, X off my phone too.
I didn't even bother. It just kind of like, what was it, the offload apps thing? If you don't use it for long enough, it just goes away. That's what happened. So
just follow us on Instagram, CWTPOD. That's where you're gonna see when our episodes go up. So
yeah. Cool. All right. So until next time, we can say bye.
Okay, bye.